In this hour of Focus, we're pleased to have as our guest Michael O'Hanlon. He is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and has written on a number of issues, including arms treaties, homeland security, policy toward Iraq, military technology, missile defense, U.S. defense strategy, and others. This morning, we will try to touch on a number of issues, but to begin with, we'll be talking about the current tensions between the United States and North Korea. He has co-authored a new book that's just come out, which is titled Crisis on the Korean Peninsula, the subtitle How to Deal with a Nuclear North Korea. It is published by McGraw-Hill, if you're interested in reading it. And of course, if you'd like to find out more about Brookings, they have a website and there's a lot of information there, various kinds of policy papers and op-ed pieces written by people who work at Brookings. And that's www.brookings.edu. So if you're interested, you can go to that site and see what is there. And of course, this morning, as we talk with Michael O'Hanlon, you certainly should feel free to be a part of the conversation. The only thing that we ask of callers is that they're brief so that we can get in as many people as possible and, of course, keep the program moving. In addition to his involvement with Brookings, Michael O'Hanlon teaches at Princeton and Columbia universities. His work's been published in a number of places, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs. He's also appeared in many networks and done a lot of interviews, ABC, CNN, A&E, and others. And he's talking with us this morning from Washington. Dr. O'Hanlon, hello.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Well, thank you very much for giving us your time. We certainly appreciate it. To begin, I'd like to talk about Korea and also establish some context, because this kind of tension, the sort of problems that the United States is having now with North Korea, these are not new. In fact, something like 10 years ago, with another administration, we were very much in the same place before the kind of agreement that came to be called the agreed framework was worked out in 1994. So maybe we can talk a little bit about, go back to the Clinton administration and talk a little bit about the approach that administration took, and perhaps the pros and cons, and then we can talk about the current administration.
Yeah, great. That's a good approach. And if you don't mind, I'll even start just for a couple sentences even further back than that.
Sure.
And just say that in broad terms, as you well know, North Korea, of course, invaded South Korea in 1950. Over the first couple decades of the two Koreas' separation from each other, North Korea probably had the upper hand in military capability and industrial production. But by the 70s, the table started to turn. South Korea, of course, became over time a very wealthy, westernized country, very strong democracy as well. And so by the 80s, you had a situation where South Korea really had the upper hand by most metrics. And then the Cold War ended and added insult to injury for North Korea because it lost its Soviet bloc markets and much of its Soviet assistance. And so this is the broad context in which you have to understand the early 1990s as well as today. Also in this time period, as you were alluding to, North Korea was making progress towards some kind of a nuclear capability. They had built a small research reactor in the course of earlier decades and had the thing operational basically during the first Bush administration. That was the period of time when they were producing a fair amount of plutonium just by the operation of this reactor. And they were believed to have stopped the reactor and taken some of the plutonium, the fuel rods that contain plutonium, away to reprocess them to extract the plutonium for possible nuclear capability. That's the situation the Clinton administration inherited at a time when U.S. intelligence thought that North Korea had enough plutonium for one or possibly two bombs. No one really knew or knows for a fact if they actually have the nuclear weapons, but we all assume they probably do because getting the plutonium is typically the hardest part of the process. So in that context, the Clinton administration wanted to make sure things didn't get any worse and ultimately, if possible, even get rid of the one or two bombs. So the deal they worked out in 94 was to say to North Korea, we will not only demand that you shut down this small research reactor, we'll demand that you stop construction on the larger nuclear reactors you're intending to build someday that could produce enough plutonium for dozens of bombs per year. But as a concession or to help you with your energy requirements, which is what you say you really want the reactors for, even though we doubt that, we will provide you with a different kind of nuclear reactor that is less good for making plutonium, but should satisfy your energy needs. And in the interim period, we'll provide you with fuel oil so you can produce energy equivalent to what you might have had from the nuclear program. That was the basic deal the Clinton administration worked out. It's actually a pretty good deal on the broad picture, because we can verify what the North Koreans are doing with big nuclear reactors, and we can have international inspectors, as well as using satellite imagery to verify that they are keeping their end of the bargain, and all we had to do was to provide them some fuel oil. Some people said this was giving into blackmail, but on the face of it, it was energy for energy. We were giving them enough energy to compensate for the nuclear reactors they were not constructing, not utilizing. And I think it was a smart deal. They could have had 50 nuclear weapons by now if we hadn't agreed to that deal. Unfortunately, as we all are painfully aware by now, this did not have the ability to prevent the North Koreans from going underground with clandestine, albeit smaller, nuclear capabilities and nuclear programs, and specifically this uranium enrichment program that began in the latter years of the Clinton presidency, was discovered by American intelligence in the course of 2002, and we confronted North Korea with our knowledge of this program last year, and that's really the immediate cause of the breakdown in relations and the acceleration of all aspects of the North Korean nuclear program since that time. Mm-hmm. So that's a capsule history of what's been going on here.
So the United States, for its part, was hoping to prevent the North Koreans from developing nuclear weapons. The Koreans on their side, they had a number of concerns. They wanted economic assistance. They wanted help with their energy needs. I think also one thing that the North Koreans seem to be looking for is they would like to have more normal relations with the rest of the world. So the deal was worked out. Now, people have been critical, and perhaps justly critical, of the North Koreans for not bargaining in good faith. On the other side of this, though, these commitments that the United States made to try to help build some nuclear plants to generate energy, to provide some other energy assistance, those things that the United States said it would do, the United States never did. I mean, that's what the Koreans on their side are saying, well, you know, you made some promises to us and didn't follow through. Why is it that those things that were part of this agreed framework in 94 that the United States committed itself to never happened?
Well, you're right to raise this broader set of questions. First of all, the agreed framework, to take the economic issue and the diplomatic relations subject that you mentioned first, the agreed framework said there should be progress towards those things, but the nuclear stuff is what was specific and what was bargained about in detail. And so both sides were essentially disappointed in the other side. The North Koreans thought we would be willing to lift our trade sanctions that we've had in place on them for decades, that we'd be perhaps willing to give some more economic assistance, that investors would flock into North Korea, and whether they're American investors or perhaps more likely South Korean investors. The North Koreans really thought that perhaps this was one way to begin to get beyond their failed command economy and compensate for the loss of Soviet aid and Soviet markets. In addition to that broader agenda, which we never really got around to on either side, as you point out, there was haggling over the implementation of the agreed framework itself. We did not go quite as far as you suggested, though. We did not deny them any and all of the replacement nuclear capabilities, but the schedule kept getting slowed down. First, the North Koreans refused to accept any kind of reactors that would have any kind of South Korean trademark or imprint on them, refusing to recognize that country, of course, and still considering it to be really part of their country, and they're not willing to, therefore, take reactors that look as if they're made in the ROK. We had to work out a modality where they could accept South Korean technology but call it something else, and that took a while. And then the South Koreans at that time were fairly hardline and could occasionally be inflammatory in their rhetoric. And then the North Koreans, of course, had the submarine come aground with commandos aboard inside South Korea. That led to a major problem in relations, and the commandos were all ultimately either killed or killed themselves. And these kinds of things kept happening, and it slowed down the works. It didn't really stop the program, but it slowed down the works. And so the North Koreans, if they wanted to, could argue that we were not acting in good faith because we were not meeting the timelines that were specified in the agreed framework. But on the other hand, they had something to do with those timelines being slowed down themselves. So I would say on those issues, both sides could have work towards faster acceleration or faster implementation of the original accord. But the North Koreans did something that's entirely illegitimate and entirely out of bounds in regard to the framework, which is way beyond any kind of violation the United States or South Korea may have made, which is to start this underground uranium enrichment program. The 94 Accord holds North Korea to full compliance with the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. It says they cannot have this kind of capability. And it goes further, and it says any of their nuclear facilities will be under more rigorous inspections. And they, in their efforts to develop a nuclear weapons capability underground, violated the Nonproliferation Treaty, to which they were still party at the time, violated, therefore, the agreed framework. And this was not something that could be portrayed as just a slowdown in implementation or a bargaining tactic. It was a fundamental repudiation of their basic obligations. And so, even though I've been critical myself of the Bush administration for being so hard-line with the North Koreans, on this point, I think the Bush administration is absolutely right. North Korea is in the wrong, and it's really just that simple.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Michael O'Hanlon. He is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and has written on a wide variety of issues, including homeland security, military technology, U.S. defense strategy. His most recent book, which he co-authored with Mike Mochizuki, is titled Crisis on the Korean Peninsula, How to Deal with a Nuclear North Korea. So if you're interested in that subject, you can look for that book. He's also one of the contributors to a book titled Protecting the American Homeland 1 Year On, that was published also this year. He's written many op-ed pieces that have appeared in a variety of different newspapers. And again, if you're interested in reading about Brookings, you can go to their website, and there are many things there in the way of policy papers and background information on a wide variety of foreign policy and also domestic policy matters. Questions are welcome too, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It's very difficult for us to try to understand the thinking of the leadership of North Korea, but it seems to be on the face of it that, as we talked a little bit about earlier, that they are interested in, certainly they are interested in various kinds of assistance. They seem to be interested in improving their relationship with the rest of the world. And that when you ask, well, why is it that they're doing what they are, that they're pursuing this nuclear program, it would seem to be that it's they think it's the only big stick that they have, and that they think that, well, if we do this, then this gives us something to bargain with the rest of the world. Now, and by the same token, the current administration has said some very strong things about North Korea, and some people say, well, the North Koreans are actually worried about the possibility of being attacked by the United States, and they actually think that they, for their defense, and they need nuclear weapons, so it's not just a bargaining chip, but it's something that they think that they need. What is your, to the extent that it can be read, what is your reading of the mindset of the leadership of North Korea?
Well, first of all, I think you put it very well, and let me just reiterate those points, that we have two main contending theories about why the North Koreans want nuclear weapons, or a nuclear deterrent, as they tend to call it when they're discussing this issue with American negotiators. One is that it's potentially their only route towards greater economic help and towards more international attention, because we're otherwise content to focus on Iraq and Afghanistan and the Middle East and so forth and ignore them. And secondly, perhaps they're so worried about military preemption and Mr. Bush's so-called axis of evil and his policy of regime change that they think they're next after Saddam, and therefore they need these weapons as a deterrent to protect themselves. The CIA and other parts of U.S. intelligence are divided and unsure about which of these two theories is more likely to be accurate. All we can say is that I think the uranium enrichment program that forced this crisis in the first place, having been begun under President Clinton, was not a response itself to the axis of evil and military preemption concepts of President Bush. Whether it's become that we don't know. But it was not initially begun that way. So I think your theory is correct, the one you began with. I tend to think that this is the way they see themselves getting more leverage in international negotiations. And they thought they could perhaps hide this program from us maybe someday unveil their capability or have this backup nuclear deterrent in place just in case. So maybe they were actually even a little afraid of President Clinton. And even though he gave them no particular reason to think he was going to attack in the late 1990s, they remembered back to the threatening words that Secretary of Defense Perry had used in 1994 when the crisis was at a head before the agreed framework was negotiated. And they thought, you know, if the United States is ever going to threaten us again, we want to have some kind of a nuclear capability just in case. So we'll have our cake and eat it, too. We'll agree to this deal on the plutonium reactors that are above ground and verifiable and observable by the United States. But meanwhile, we'll also have a backup program for our national security. So even in the late 1990s, you can't really tell what the North Koreans were thinking. The evidence does, to me, tend to suggest that they care more about having this nuclear program as a bargaining chip than as a deterrent. And after all, they gave up the capability to have 50 nuclear weapons by now when they agreed to the agreed framework, which they probably could have otherwise had. So I tend to think we can talk them out of this if we are very clear that it's unacceptable, that in the end we will up the pressure as necessary if they don't give it up. But before we get to that point, we're going to give them some pretty interesting incentives, incentives that will give them hope of getting out of this economic mess they're in. And in exchange for the incentives, for economic assistance, for lifting of trade sanctions, for diplomatic ties, for a peace treaty, in exchange for all that, we're going to force the North Koreans to reform not just their nuclear program and the elimination of that, but cuts in their conventional forces, which are enormous and a huge drain on their economy, a beginning of economic enterprise zones, sort of like what Vietnam and China have introduced in the last 25 years, and more generally, an opening up to the outside world. And if they're prepared to do those things, we're prepared to help them along the way. That's the basic argument of our book. That's the long-term vision of the Bush administration, but the Bush administration is not willing to put most of those kinds of incentives on the table until the nuclear question is resolved. And we just don't see that as very realistic, because to finish and to come back to your initial point, I think this is, in the North Korean eyes, their only real powerful point of leverage with the international community, and they're not likely to give it up unless they get a fair amount in return.
Let us talk with some callers. We have a couple, and someone starting out here on a cell phone, so I wanted to get to them on line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question, and I'll hang up and listen to the answer. In the 1940s, there was no they, there was Stalin. In the 1990s, there was no there was Saddam Hussein. When you talk about North Korea, are we talking about a they, or are we talking about this apparently nutty, that's not the right word, leader? In other words, is there a bureaucracy? Are there people who make decisions other than this one individual? Are they just
great question.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, thank you for the question. It's a great question. The first thing to say is that North Korea is probably the most inscrutable society on Earth right now, the hardest to get into and the most opaque to our intelligence analysts and to even people who have had the chance to visit that country. I have not yet had the chance to visit North Korea, and I should acknowledge that. Secondly, however, there still are theories that there probably are competing camps within North Korea, some more inclined to try reform and engage with the outside world, others much more paranoid, traditionally Stalinist, and so forth. Kim Jong-il seems to be more in the first camp. He seems to be willing to try reform, although he's very nervous about it. He thinks that he could easily lose power. He doesn't know how to make it work. He thinks he could perhaps incite his military hardliners into a coup. He has tried some measure of economic reform in bits and pieces over the last few years, but not with any great enthusiasm or dedication or success. So from what we can tell, even though Kim Jong-il is, you know, the top-level leader and he is the first dynasty in the communist world in history, having, you know, been the son of the founding leader, Kim Il-sung, even though he is in that commanding position, he still has to worry about his government and camps of hardliners and reformists who may be at odds with each other. If you got rid of Kim Jong-il somehow, if he died tomorrow of a heart attack, I think that North Korea would remain a huge problem for the United States, because I think there is enough of this Stalinist system entrenched that, just as in the Soviet Union, when Stalin was gone, maybe you got somebody a little better, but you still had a Soviet system, and it took 30 years to get a Gorbachev. And I think that would be the same sort of thing we would have to expect here, that even if the very top leader was gone, you might not get anybody much better and perhaps even worse. Because I do think Kim Jong-il, even though he's not been successful about it so far, he's at least interested in exploring ideas for reform. And that already puts him, in some ways, in the more moderate of the two camps that we think we can detect inside North Korea.
All right. Let us go to another caller. This is someone in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. You said that that the North Korean underground uranium production was what led to this nuclear issue with North Korea, but you didn't say anything about the fact that the Bush administration, right before this whole thing started, the Bush administration stopped shipping fuel oil to North Korea as we promised them in the Clinton administration.
Well, we did that after we discovered the uranium enrichment program, and it was not before that time. And so I think there is ground, is sufficient evidence here for criticizing President Bush on his broader North Korea policy, but I would not choose to do it on that particular point. I would have personally kept the fuel oil shipments going for a while to see if we could talk the North Koreans into a more compliant kind of behavior. But leaving aside that tactical difference with Mr. Bush, my real criticism of him is his broader strategic approach to North Korea, where I do think his doctrine of preemption has been a mistake. It didn't cause the crisis. It didn't produce the uranium enrichment program. That was already underway. But it really did, I think, lead to the intensification of this crisis. And the North Koreans felt that they had to worry about President Bush perhaps attacking them, certainly not showing them any kind of diplomatic or economic benefits, unless they were to do every single thing that he demanded first. So I'm not trying to apologize for the North Korean regime, which is a terrible regime and one of the worst on earth, but I do think President Bush exacerbated the negative dynamics in the relationship with his rhetoric, with his doctrine of preemption, and that's where I would be critical of him. The fuel oil issue, as I say, only became a problem, and we only cut off shipments after we had uncovered this uranium enrichment program, which was totally illegal and totally inappropriate on the North Koreans' part.
Okay, so that reaction just made a pre-existing situation worse instead of creating the situation itself.
That's what I would say, but I would go further in my criticism and say that we were starting to see some progress with the North Koreans. Obviously, not enough. They started this uranium enrichment program during the very time when there seemed to be some progress in relations at another level. But we were starting to see more engagement. We were starting to see detente between the North Koreans and the South Koreans. The North Koreans very much wanted to have greater involvement with the United States diplomatically in the last couple of years of the Clinton administration. I think there was a way to give the North Koreans a tough deal. If you reform your economy and your society more than you have been willing to do so far, we will help you with that reform process. I think that dynamic was working reasonably well towards the end of the Clinton administration, and we could have accelerated it, and Mr. Bush instead totally reversed course. So I would be critical of his strategy in those terms. But on the narrow issue of the nukes and the fuel oil, I think the North Koreans really were the problem.
All right. Well, it sounds like the whole North Korea thing is something that should be treated very, very carefully and should be given a lot of thought by whatever administration is having to deal with it.
Yeah, we're starting to see some more. I do take some heart in that the Bush administration is spending a little more time on this now, that I do believe Mr. Powell is having a little more influence on the policy right now, as well as his deputy, Richard Armitage, who's an old Asia hand and knows the region quite well. And I see people like Senator Kerry on the Democratic presidential side trying to push more attention on the issue and also produce some new ideas for constructive engagement. So I'm a little more hopeful that we're in a better place than we were a month ago, but we've still got a long ways to go.
All right. Well, I hope it goes better in the future.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Fairly recently, there were talks involving the United States and North and South Korea, China, Japan, and Russia, it seems that they didn't yield much except an agreement to meet again. Although no date or time, as far as the recent stories that I've said, there's no date or time been set. Was this significant for any other reason other than it happened? That is, the talks happened? Did anything come out of that other than the fact we could say, well, they all sat down and talked?
I think you're mostly right in saying that's the benefit, and therefore it's a very fragile and fleeting benefit unless we build upon it and get serious on a substantive agenda very soon. And there's no sign yet we'll be successful or willing to give the North Koreans any real incentives for coming to the table and engaging in a more serious way. So I think right now we've got this very sort of tactical, symbolic first step that we have these six-party negotiations, and the other four countries are with us and not with the North Koreans. And that became fairly evident from what I understand of the dynamics of the negotiation. In fact, there were times where Russia would tell North Korea that they were purposely misreading Mr. Bush. And Russia would say, no, Bush has no intention of attacking you. We know that full well from examining all of his statements from the conversations he's had with Mr. Putin. So the six-party dynamic changed the dynamic. It made the North Koreans feel less successful with their traditional tactics of blackmail and bluster and threat and lying and dividing one country from another. And so in that sense, there could be some important procedural benefits here, but only if we get on with a more serious substantive agenda in the next round of talks.
We are already at our midpoint. We have another caller we will get right to. I would like to introduce again the guest for this hour. We're speaking with Michael O'Hanlon. He is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and has written on a wide variety of issues, U.S. defense strategy, homeland security, just to name a couple. His op-eds have appeared in many newspapers around the United States. He's authored a number of books. His most recent is work that he co-authored, which is titled Crisis on the Korean Peninsula, How to Deal with a Nuclear North Korea. It's published by McGraw-Hill. So if you're interested in reading on this issue, you look for that book. Questions also are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign County on our line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. Rather than focus on the current events and the assessment of the talks and whether the table was hexagonal or pentagonal or whatever, I wanted to just make a shout-out to the idea that there are so many misconceptions that the U.S. has about North Korea and the Korean War, and maybe that's why everything seems so inscrutable over there in what used to be called the Orient. And I wanted to reference Bruce Cummings, who one doesn't hear so much on the mainstream media anymore. He's kind of been relegated to alternative sources like Democracy Now!, where he is heard occasionally. But he wrote the foreword to I.F. Stone's book, The Hidden History of the Korean War, which was a contemporaneous writing of what he thought was really going on at the time. And it's much more complicated than people would have it in after all these many years. And it's kind of refreshing to see it, actually. And the reason why I bring that up is just because I think that while we're talking about this and the threat and everything, what we're not talking about anymore is just how much so many South Koreans want the U.S. out, despite the fact that these machinations are going on over their heads. They still want to unify. They still want the U.S. out, and we don't visit that subject very much. And there are so many reasons for it that don't get visited. And while we're agitating about this, they get less. You would think it would be an occasion for visiting those kind of subjects, but no, it's just all seen in the terms of nuclear threat, how terrorist is this regime or not, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know how you want to respond to that. I don't know if you've ever been head-to-head with Cummings, who is at the University of Chicago, and I'm sure they could provide a nice high ISDN line for an interview with him in the future. And I'll hang up and listen and see if there are any other callers locally here. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, thank you for that, too. Cummings is a smart guy. He's followed this issue for a long time. I don't agree with much of what he writes, but I'm sure he doesn't agree with much of what I write. And I would say the following, that South Korean politics today are fascinating. Let me build on that point for just a second. And South Korea is ambivalent about its relationship with the United States. And frankly, this has become much more acute under President Bush because South Koreans, in many cases, Well, there are a number of different reasons, one of which is that many South Koreans just want to get on with the world. They can't quite believe that war really is a possibility. Some people are being, frankly, a little blissfully ignorant or willfully blissfully ignorant of the threat they still face from the North. But to be fair, and to back up the caller's point, they see Mr. Bush as exacerbating the problem with North Korea, and they don't believe that it would be as acute right now were it not for this American policy. And if we had kept on in the spirit of Nobel Prize winner Kim Dae-jung, the previous president of South Korea, or his successor, President No, then we would be in a much better position vis-a-vis the North. That's a second part of the reason why South Koreans are ambivalent about their current relationship with the United States. A third part is, of course, the history of being associated with a country that's always been bigger and stronger and more advanced. And even though the South Koreans have caught up in many ways in per capita terms, they still are obviously a relatively small country. And that breeds certain kinds of dynamics and psychologies that make people both want to have a relationship with the United States, but also feel a little ambivalent about it or resentful at times. And then, you know, there are all the internal domestic political quarrels inside of South Korea, which has a very vibrant democracy, and different groups take different sides in various issues. The more pro-American candidate lost the last election, and that makes certain, you know, certain parties want to take on President Bush and so forth. You put all that together, and it makes for a big and interesting and volatile mix. I don't really think the South Koreans want to break off their security treaty with the United States, but I do believe that they want us to get along with the North Koreans to the extent possible, or at least propose an idea that would give some hope for that possibility before we resort to this more coercive and more hard-headed approach that may be a little hard-headed in some ways and sober-minded, but it's also fairly hard-hearted and doesn't really offer the opportunity for an improvement in relations, even if the North Koreans are looking for that.
Let's go to another caller. This is someone in Chicago on our line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to comment on the situation in not only in Korea but worldwide. It seems a lot of parallels exist between the times we live in, this decade, and the 1930s. If you studied anything about that time, there were worldwide recession and trade problems and disputes between nations and a lot of localized conflicts going on. And it seems to be the same situation today. That's happening in the world, and that decade culminated in a great world war. And it seems that even with our relationship with Japan before the time of the Second World War was won over this fuel oil situation. I think Japan actually got into a dispute with America over the access to fuel oil. And I'm just wondering what you might think if this has potential to combine with the Iraq situation and Middle East situation to kind of erupt into a kind of a worldwide conflict as it did, unfortunately, back in the late 1930s and early 1940s, if that has the potential a few years down the line of developing into something like that.
That's an interesting historical analogy, and I'm glad you brought it up, but I would use it to be a little more reassuring in a way, because as you point out, we had to contend with the likes of Japan and Germany in the 1930s and 40s, big industrial countries, not on the scale of the United States, but quite large. Today, we're dealing with countries like Iraq and North Korea, which are much smaller countries, much less economically capable. Unfortunately, weapons have advanced to the point where even a small country or a terrorist organization can get its hands on weapons of mass destruction. So it's not a comforting situation. But there's no real doubt in my mind that North Korea is not in a position to really take us on. And moreover, the other great powers in the region tend to want to put pressure on North Korea themselves. Now, that will vary from country to country. China has been critical, for example, of the American role in last week's talks. China thinks we went too far in a hardline direction. On the other hand, at the talks themselves, China was tough on North Korea. And China is very concerned about North Korea's nuclear program, does not want to encourage it, does not want to accept it. So on balance, we are in the fortunate position that most of the other great powers in the world today are either our close treaty allies or at least partners we can work with on issues like this, countries such as China and Russia. So I'm not as worried as you are about a repeat of the 30s, but I do think that when you throw in the mix of global terrorism, apocalyptic terrorism like al-Qaeda, and weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons in North Korean hands, we still have plenty of reason to worry and to take this problem extraordinarily seriously.
thank you for your comments.
All right. Thank you. We have time for others. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. If you'd like to call in, 333-WILL or 9455. That's a little easier. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I wonder if I could ask you about just a slightly different but certainly related topic. And that has to do with the structure of the American military, something that you've written about. When Don Rumsfeld came into office, became the Secretary of Defense, he apparently had the idea that he wanted to change the structure of defense in this country. And he has been the one who has enthusiastically advocated employing high technology for greater sort of surveillance, battlefield awareness, for guidance of weapons and a wide variety of things. And the test case of that seems to be Iraq. Now, also, there are people who have argued that that's forgetting one thing, that you can have all the technology in the world, but you also have to have people. You have to have troops. And now there's a big argument going on about just how many we need, how badly overextended are we, can we do what we're talking about doing with the kind of with the numbers that we have now. And I think that you have been one of those that has said that, in fact, what we need is we do indeed need more people. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, happy to. It's, as you say, a very acute issue right now, especially for the U.S. Army. In the 1990s, the U.S. Air Force and Navy were working very hard. The Army was, too, and so were the Marines. But since the overthrow of Saddam, in many ways, the Air Force's mission has become somewhat easier. It doesn't have to worry about maintaining air patrols over Iraq all the time. And the Navy's mission's a bit easier as well. It doesn't have to worry about as many patrols in the Persian Gulf. The Marines are actually reducing their numbers in Iraq quite dramatically and portraying themselves as a force that is for rapid response, not for long-term stabilization or occupation. Therefore, it really is the U.S. Army that is most stressed here. The problem is really fairly easy to see. For one thing, we have more than 100,000 Army reservists called up to active duty now. Of course, many of them had been called up even before the Iraq problem because of 9/11. And that's, on balance, we have about a quarter of all reservists called up already. And some units have been called up even more than once since 9/11. What that tells you is that people who joined the reserve component, either the Army Reserve or the Army National Guard, and thought of it as primarily weekend and summer activity, maybe be called up once or twice in their lives for an acute national emergency, are now anticipating a period over which time they're going to have to perhaps be called up even more than once because the Iraq mission is so demanding on American forces, and it comes on top of other missions that are smaller, but still it all adds up. So you have the problem with the reserves. You also have the problem with the active duty combat force because we have a total of 33 main combat brigades in the active army, 33. That's the main sort of, you know, a good way to measure the main unit of combat capability. Of those 33, 14 are still in Iraq, and two more were in Iraq until just a few weeks ago. We have two in Korea. They've been there for a long time, and people rotate in and out, but the two brigades are there without their families in difficult circumstances, you know, relatively decent quarters, but away from their families and in a relatively tense zone. And then we have one brigade inside Afghanistan. So we have a total of 17 of our 33 brigades deployed at any one time. In theory, you can do that, but how do you sustain that over a period of perhaps 3-4 years? Which I think is what the Iraq mission will take at a minimum. We may be able to reduce the numbers in Iraq over time, but right now it's 17 out of 33 brigades that are doing some kind of an overseas deployment away from their families and in fairly difficult circumstances and often quite dangerous circumstances. So you're in a situation where you're going to have to send some units overseas after just a few months at home. They're going to do a tour in Iraq or South Korea or Afghanistan, come home, maybe get 6 months off, maybe 9 months off, and then get ready to go back overseas to a dangerous combat zone again. And I believe this runs the risk of pushing people out of the Army. They're just not going to want to put up with it. The all-volunteer Army that's such a magnificent and capable institution will be at risk. So I think the only thing you can do is try to mitigate this problem every single way possible. You have to be willing to give the United Nations more of a role in Iraq, or at least at least have the UN as the overseer and maybe have Ambassador Paul Bremer be the special representative for the UN, whatever it takes to get countries like India, France, and Germany to contribute troops. Mm. On top of that, you need to get the Marines involved in Iraq again. They fought magnificently in the war, but they're essentially getting out of the stabilization mission. I don't think we have the luxury of letting them do that. We have to keep making use of different parts of the National Guard that have not yet been called up where we can. And then finally, we need a larger army. And if you do the math, I think you need one or two more divisions. This is not some enormous Vietnam-like or World War II-like buildup, but it does suggest, to my mind, that you need somewhere between 30,000 and 50,000 more soldiers in the active duty army, at least for the next 3 years or so. If you do all those things collectively, then you can get a rotation policy in place where somebody only spends one out of every 3 or 4 years overseas. So there's a space of at least 2 years between deployments. And I think that's a minimum standard we should hold ourselves to treat our troops decently and make sure that we don't drive them out of the military.
You know, another thing I want to ask you about, when the Bush administration came in and a lot of the people that advised him, particularly when it came to foreign policy and defense issues, came in with this attitude that the United States can and should exercise its power around the world to not only in its own defense, but also to remake the world in the fashion that they thought that it should be. And particularly, they seem to direct their attention to the Middle East. Now that we see just how difficult Iraq has become and will continue to be, and rebuilding that country after the war, how has that changed the way people think in Washington? Are people actually talking about this whole idea of the United States, its place on the world stage, just how much power it has, how it should exercise that power, which sort of philosophy should guide it, and are people actually now talking out loud and saying that the kind of mindset that a lot of the Bush people came in with simply was wrong?
Well, it's a good question. I do think Washington is sort of back on its heels. I mean, we don't feel, leaving aside my own views, the town as a whole doesn't bream with confidence these days. You don't get the sense that people are just, you know, brimming over with a belief they can remake the world. Even the sort of Paul Wolfowitz neocon crowd seems to be on the defensive a little bit and seems to be more worried about just getting the problem fixed in Iraq and keeping the lid on North Korea than on remaking the world in some democratic image. I like much of the idealistic rhetoric of remaking the region, the Middle East region, the Persian Gulf region. I like the idea of doing more humanitarian interventions. I give the president a lot of credit for the improvement in the situation in Liberia, which gets quickly forgotten, but I think he's done a pretty good job there. And so I like some of this, but you don't get the sense right now in Washington that people are looking for the next place to get involved. We're just hoping to limit the damage and limit the liability in the places we're already present. And if we can do that, I think people will be content. So whatever thinking there was at one time about remaking the region or larger swaths of the world in the democratic Western image, I think, is not getting much play at the moment. I would just add one more point, which is I'm not sure that crowd really ever had that much influence with Mr. Bush, except in the immediate period after the Iraq War when everything seems so easy. And it's or maybe in the period between the fall of the Taliban and the fall of Saddam, maybe for that 15-month period, things did seem a little easier. We did seem to have a little more confidence. The high-tech Rumsfeld way of war seemed to be this great new magic wand in our arsenal. And until we saw the limitations of that in both Afghanistan and Iraq in the post-war efforts, and until we saw the North Korea crisis get worse, and until we saw the president's popularity come quite a bit downward, there was a certain hubris, but I think it's pretty much gone.
Mm. Next week will mark the second anniversary of 9/11. And certainly since that time, there has been an awful lot of discussion about what happened, about intelligence failures, about how our infrastructure is not prepared to deal with crisis like that. And there have been panels and commissions and oceans of ink spilled writing about this particular issue. And I guess it makes me want to ask the question now, 2 years on, are we any better prepared to deal with something like that than we were 2 years ago?
Yes, we are. You can argue whether we're well enough prepared, and I would tend to say no. You can argue whether Washington's made a reasonable amount of progress in 24 months, and I would say maybe. That's sort of a judgment call and debatable. But we certainly are much better off. For one thing, we are integrating these terrorist watch lists much more effectively. We have a much better sense of which al-Qaeda elements may be in the United States. I think surveillance for them and a readiness to act quickly against them has improved quite a bit. The interrogations of people we've arrested around the world have yielded a lot of insights into what tactics might be planned. That's led to things like patrolling the areas around runways for people who might be holding surface-to-air missiles, and I think we've made some adjustments there. Certainly, I think in air safety and in airport security, airplane security, we're much better off. Certainly, we've begun to make some progress on the biological weapons issue, a lot more research going into finding various kinds of antidotes and medications. There was, of course, the imbroglio over smallpox and whether to get people vaccinated there. But frankly, with Saddam Hussein out of the picture now, I think the urgency of the smallpox threat is a little bit less acute because there was some worry that he might have had access to smallpox. And as long as he was in the picture, there was some chance that the smallpox would get into the hands of al-Qaeda. Maybe it's still in Iraq. Maybe it will get into the hands of al-Qaeda. But it was a pretty remote possibility to begin with, and I think even more so now. So on the biological issue, on the airport issue, I think we're in better shape. We're starting to do a better job of defending certain kinds of public infrastructure like bridges, although clearly not all the time. And you know, to the extent the alert system doesn't work well, we could have some problems there. But having said all of that, there's a lot more to do, and I won't go through a long inventory, but I'll quickly just say one thing. Private sector infrastructure of certain types, I think, is not nearly well enough protected, and there's not really a plan to protect it. For example, skyscrapers with their air circulation systems potentially usable to distribute anthrax in a biological weapons attack, with many of these air intakes near ground level and unprotected, or chemical production facilities, which have not received any kind of detailed scrutiny from government to the point of mandating any kind of improvements in their safety standards or that they carry insurance against terrorism. The insurance would be a mechanism by which you could try to encourage them to improve their own safety practices in return for better rates, and we're not mandating that kind of terrorism insurance. So a whole host of private sector infrastructure, trucking, you know, toxic materials being trucked around the country and through cities with very poor security on where these trucks are kept or on who drives them. This is also an area that we've done very little to improve our monitoring or our ability to thwart any attack. So I think that the glass is only half full. It's a lot closer to a serious strategy now than 2 years ago, but we've still got a long ways to go.
Well, there, I think that we'll leave it with our thanks to you, Dr. O'Hanlon, that we really appreciate you giving us some of your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest, Michael O'Hanlon. He is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. We also want to say thanks to the folks there for helping us with this high-quality connection. If you're interested in reading about Brookings, you can go to their website. And also, if you're interested in reading on the subject of North Korea, you can look for a recent book co-authored by our guest, Michael O'Hanlon. The title is Crisis on the Korean Peninsula, and it's published by McGraw-Hill.